It's hard to deny that there's a large mental gap between humans and animals, from the founding of civilizations to the ability to just sit down and talk to each other. The capabilities of human beings seem vastly more versatile than any other species, but why are we the only ones who can do these things?
In a new book, our next guest explores the science behind the gap between humans and other animals, how our differences came to be, and why humans have come to dominate the Earth.
Joining us now is Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and the author of The Gap, The Science of What Separates Us from Other Animals. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hello there, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I should say good morning to you. It's 9 o'clock, right?
That's right. Greetings from Australia.
And it's dark here already in Wisconsin.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it'd be lovely to be where you are. Well, let's dig into your book a little bit. As humans, it's tempting to think that we're separate and different from animals since we're the dominant ones on the planet. Mm-hmm. It's not that clear-cut, is it?
Well, I see. You see, on the one hand, every species is unique, and in that sense, humans are no different. Still, it does seem obvious that there's something extra special about us. After all, I mean, we are the species running the zoos. So what I would try to do in my book is to examine more carefully and systematically what precisely really sets us apart. Physically, of course, we are very similar from other animals. We share the same flesh and blood, if you think about it. You can take a pig's heart valve and place it into a human body, and it will work fine. So the physical continuity between humans and animals is simply incontestable. But I think the mind is another matter. We dominate the planet through our collective wit, I think, and have spawned civilizations and technologies that have ultimately changed the face of the Earth, whereas even our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, sit unobtrusively in their remaining forests. So there's this tremendous gap between humans and animals, and the nature and evolution of that gap has been the topic of my research for the last 10, 20 years, and is the topic of this book that you're referring to.
Well, if it's the mind, a lot of people might then turn toward the brain and wonder, well, are our brains bigger? Does size matter when it comes to brains and more powerful mind?
Yeah, you'd think so. Human brains are very large, 1.25 to 1.45 kilograms, but other animals, elephants and whales, have much larger brains than us. Elephants have brains of weighing almost 4 kilograms. The brains of whales can be up to 9 kilograms. Now, obviously, whales and elephants also are the biggest animals around altogether, so perhaps that's not a fair comparison. If you look at relative brain size, we actually beat elephants and whales. Our brains are comprising about 2% of our body, whereas the brains of elephants and whales comprise less than 1%. So we've got larger relative brains than these guys. But when you use relative brain comparisons, then our sense of superiority also does not get entirely supported, because it turns out some shrews and mice can have relative brain sizes of up to 10%. So we get beaten by large animals in one scheme and by small animals in the other scheme. So people have come up with a third scheme that takes into account that as mammals get larger, the absolute size of their brains get larger, but the relative size gets smaller. If we then do a regression analysis, we can find that humans at last have the largest brains predicted for the size of our body. So we are on top in that scheme, followed by dolphins, by the way, who have got about 5 times the expected value. We have about 7 times the expected value.
So we have a pretty good mind-to-body ratio, but I guess the important question is, what can we do with our brains that animals, by and large, are not doing?
That's right. I mean, obviously, on the one hand, we could cite thousands of things that we are doing. We buy insurance, we talk to each other, we have radio, we have iPhones. But what I'd like to look at is, what are the essential bits that got us to this level, things that are universally unique. And to that end, I go through all the major claims that have been made in the literature. So these are things like language, foresight, mind reading, intelligence, culture, morality, and so forth. And in each one of these domains, I find that actually animals, in particular our closest relatives, the great apes, have some capacities, actually surprisingly sophisticated capacities. Yet there are certain things that even there set us apart. And to cut a long story short, I've repeatedly come across two things in all of those domains that seem to set us apart. Firstly, our ability to imagine alternative situations, be they past situations, the future, or entirely fictional events, and embed them into larger narratives. And secondly, our fundamental deep-seated drive to exchange our thoughts, tell each other what we've learned from these thoughts and experiences. So these two things keep cropping up.
Let's run with those a little bit, and the second one first. We obviously share our stories with each other a lot. We're doing it right now.
Yeah.
Many animals do communicate in some sense or another. As you mentioned, there's some sort of language or at least communication. How sure are we that we're really the only species that's doing that?
Right. There's two things to this. One is how certain we are, and for that is true across the board for all things that I examine. We can't reason from absence of evidence. It's not the same as evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to go and examine species in terms of what they are capable of. Now, in terms of and give them the opportunity to show their competence to us. And the more we give them the opportunity and the more they fail, the more we can get confident that really they don't have the capacity. So proving a universal negative is really hard to do in principle. You know, if you think about it, all you need is one case of an animal showing competence to ruin this so-called claim of a universal negative. But we can do that. The more we look, the more confident we get. And the more we've looked at animal communication, the more we find that, yes, there are sophisticated communication systems out there, but typically they seem to be reasonably fixed in terms of the messages that they convey. And they have typically to do with territory, mating, warning, and so forth. And they do seem to lack this openness, this flexibility that really characterizes human language. I mean, ultimately, I can make sentences such as this one that I've made have not uttered before ever in my life, and you can hopefully understand the sentence even though you've never heard it before. So we can combine a limited number of symbols into an open-ended set of constructions and thereby can ultimately convey virtually anything. And we don't really see anything like that in the communication system of animals.
Could you argue that it's a matter of degree, though? You know, you look at chimpanzees and some of the work, mm-hmm. you know, for instance, that Franz De Waal has done, mm-hmm. looking at how they've taught one another to dig for termites with a stick, where to find it, or even, you know, look at something like a hive of bees who seem to tell other bees where to go, where they've been to find the best foraging for flowers. Is it something on a sliding scale, or is it something that really only humans can do?
Right. There's a temptation to put it on a scale because clearly that other animals can communicate certain things. So that you gave the bee dance example, and bees can indeed inform the hive about where food is and what the quality of the food is. But it can, for example, give you the horizontal location, but not the vertical location. So there are constraints on certain types of information that can be conveyed that we don't really seem to have. Now, we have, of course, tried to also teach animals our communication system. So you mentioned the ape language projects and where people have tried to teach our close relatives to communicate with each other, for example, with American Sign Language. And they have been very successful in a certain sense, in that they have learned hundreds of symbols and they can follow and apparently understand what we are saying to them. And they can express their capacities, their own thoughts to some extent, up to perhaps what a 2-2.5-year-old can do. But they virtually all of their communications are, the vast majority, are just commands. They are not really elaborations or questions that characterize human language. But anyway, to get to the more fundamental question, I suppose, of whether it's continuity or whether we have to make the case for qualitative difference. I think this is a question that can be a bit of a red herring, because quantitative changes can actually result into qualitative differences when you think about it. Just like you, if you change the gradually change temperature, the properties of water change from liquid to solid to gas, which you could very well characterize as qualitatively different. And the same might be true for changes in mental capacity. So by increasing our working memory capacity, that is the capacity of items we can juggle in our mind at the same time, we can gradually increase that, and yet that could have a qualitative difference in terms of what we can then do with our mind and what we can conceive of. So I think, yes, there are definitely signs of continuity, but I also think that when on close observation, there are many things that fundamentally separate us from the minds of other animals.
So that qualitative difference we would often, I think, define as human consciousness. What is it about humans that led us to develop consciousness?
Consciousness is a funny term. People use it in many different ways, if you think about it. Perhaps sometimes we subscribe... Well, on the one hand, we have this high-level notion of it, being aware about things, the way that maybe Descartes meant when he said, I think, therefore I am. But consider Milan Kundera's, the Czech novelist's reply to this. He said, I think, therefore I am is the statement of an intellectual who underrates toothache. You see, do you really need to have reflection of any sorts to be conscious when you are in pain? I think next time you doubt your own existence, go to the dentist. decline any anesthetic. So on the one hand, I think there's very good evidence that many creatures other than us are conscious in that sense of experiencing pain and having a phenomenology of some description. However, being aware and reflecting on one's own existence might really be something that maybe only few species are capable of, and perhaps being aware about us in terms of a temporal dimension in time, about our history and projecting ourselves into our future, foreseeing our own mortality and so on, in those senses, the term consciousness might be something that does, in fact, distinguish us from other animals.
We're talking about what science has to say about the difference between humans and other animals with Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland. His new book is The Gap. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now with Thomas Suddendorf about the gap between humans and animals and other animals. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions and tell us if you think there are important differences between humans and other animals.
Thomas, talking about the gap and how wide it is between humans and other animals, it's partly so wide, you write, because a lot of our closest ancestors who might have been closest to us are extinct, Australopithecines, other hominid species.
Well, that's right. I mean, at this point in time, our closest living relatives are African apes. But if you cast out your mind back 40,000 years ago, our closest living relatives would have been Neanderthals, Denisovans, the hobbits of Flores. Go back 2 million years ago, there would have been 3 genera of hominins with various species, including Paranthropus, Australopithecus, and Homo. So if you had asked the human back then, what's the difference between you and the next closest creature, the gap would have been much smaller than it is today. So in that sense, the gap really is as large as it is because these closest hominins relatives of ours have gone extinct.
And as I understand it, there's still some debate, but are we, or at least our ancestors, partly culpable for the extinction of those nearest relative species?
Well, I think there's a good likelihood. I mean, extinctions typically involve numerous factors, and they wouldn't have been any different from those for those other hominins, including, you know, radical environmental changes like ice ages, volcanic eruptions, and so on and so forth. But our ancestors might very well have had a hand in it. If you think about our recent times, we've been responsible for genocide, for the extinctions of various species, and violence might have been much more prominent than it is today. Now, the only other primate species that cooperates to kill members of its own species is our closest living relative, the chimpanzee. So this tendency of ours, this dark tendency, might have very ancient roots indeed. And so we might very well have had a hand in the extinction of our close relatives, and then in that sense maybe have burned the bridges across the gap only to find ourselves on the other side of the divide, wondering how we got here.
Now, when we look at research trying to get a handle on what degree of consciousness animals have, in the past it used to be questions like, do animals feel pain? And now it is, you know, do animals, are they self-aware? Are they conscious?
Mm-hmm.
What is, I guess, the purpose, do you think, for answering questions like this?
Well, I think essentially, to me, they are effectively the most profound questions I can ask. They have always driven me because ultimately they explain nature and how we fit in nature. What is our position in nature? Where do we come from? What are we? And where are we going? So by understanding our close relatives and ourselves in this kind of framework, I think We are asking very fundamental questions about our own existence. On top of that, of course, there are also practical applied applications to this. So, for instance, those characteristics that are absolutely uniquely human are likely dependent on those parts of our brain and of our genome that distinguish us from our close relatives. So thereby we can narrow down the search space for the fundamental neurological and genetic basis for these traits. And it might actually save various animal lives in when you think about animals being used in various medical research and psychological research, etc., as models for human disorders, etc. That only really makes sense if the animals have something similar to the human condition. And they don't make sense for those traits that are uniquely human. And even for the things that we share. You mentioned self-awareness, and there's good signs to suggest that the great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans recognize themselves in mirrors and other reflections, much like we do. Whereas we've done research with small apes, the next closest related primate, and with monkeys, and they do not pass this kind of task. They don't recognize their reflection. So when we look at the fundamental neurological basis of this trait, we should look at those attributes of the brain that humans and great apes share that we do not share with gibbons and monkeys. So we can really narrow down the search space there and make a systematic contribution to neuroscience and genetics.
Well, good.
I
wanted to go to a caller now, answering our question about what distinguishes us from other animals. Don in Norwalk is with us. Don, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I look at it like there's a sort of a moral dimension to this, that human beings have a wide range or almost a hierarchy of choices and decisions that they can make about how they relate to other people or how they handle various situations, where I think animals are more, you know, as the guest said, kind of fixed. You know, we can decide, you know, to be humane, or we could decide to be pretty savage. And, you know, it just seems like such a, you know, that possibility for us to make a moral decision seems really wide and kind of a distinguishing factor to me.
Thanks a lot for the call, Don. What do you think of that, Thomas?
I think you are quite right there, and I discussed morality at length because, again, it's one of those things that we can do because we can imagine alternative scenarios. We can reflect on what we could have done and evaluate what other people have done in a moral framework and thereby make decisions about the future in a personally responsible way that perhaps other animals cannot. So if you think about the calls that have been made in the public about giving our close relatives moral rights, then which I think is an interesting proposition, but with rights become responsibilities. And I think there's little evidence to suggest that even our close relatives, the great apes, can reflect on their own moral choices and can therefore be held morally accountable. In the past, actually, people used to think that animals are morally responsible. So in Europe, for example, I've got this anecdote from Falais in 1386 in France. There was a pig that apparently ate a human baby and then was prosecuted. It was given a lawyer. There was a court held, and eventually the sow was found guilty and hung in the public square. Interestingly, the little offspring were also accused, but then were let off because of their age. I'm not sure whether really that is the right way of going about it. So people used to think that moral obligations could be extended to other animals, but I think these days there's an insight that this makes little sense, and there's no point really prosecuting an orangutan for rape or a chimpanzee for infanticide. So I think there is a fundamental difference between us and other animals in our moral capacity, indeed.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and the author of the new book, The Gap, The Science of What Separates Us from Other Animals.